Blog Talk Radio.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
The theme of this week's show is Stay the Hell Home.
We will talk about God, governors, and the coronavirus.
Then speak with Professor Ryan Burge about his article, Atheists Are the Most Politically Active Group in the United States.
Good afternoon, and we'll have Free Thought Radio here in just a little bit, about 15-30 minutes. But we've got to do the UN news. I mean, you're getting the latest worldwide of what's going on with COVID, the pandemic, as well as war and peace issues and the countries that are involved in it. Here we go.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. African nations need more than $200 billion to withstand the immediate impacts of COVID-19 and to recover better, UN Chief Antonio Guterres has announced. At a meeting with African Union senior representatives via video conference on Wednesday, Mr. Guterres repeated his call for greater help from the International Monetary Fund and others in issuing credit for developing countries. Debt relief for countries that are unable to pay their international creditors must also be an important part of the response, the UN Secretary-General said. He also noted that a separate global appeal to help over 100 million people in humanitarian emergencies had so far raised around $400 million. Such assistance was essential in Africa as we brace for the expected spread of the pandemic, Mr. Guterres said. The disease was in no way of Africa's making, but as with the climate crisis, the African continent could end up suffering the greatest impact, he explained. Highlighting the urgent need for a safe and effective vaccine, Mr. Guterres said that it may be the only way to return the world to a sense of normality. To Europe now, where UN health experts said on Wednesday that the pandemic is far from over, despite early promising signs of falling infection rates in some countries. Dr. Hans Kluge, World Health Organization, or WHO, Regional Director for Europe, urged countries to only consider relaxing lockdown measures if they were sure that they could monitor any new disease transmission and that their health workers could cope.
Make no mistake, despite the spring weather, we remain in the midst of a storm. Several countries are yet to feel its full impact, while others are experiencing a dip as numbers of new cases of COVID-19 are falling. It is imperative that we do not let down our guard.
Latest data from the WHO shows nearly 2 million cases of new coronavirus globally, with more than 123,000 deaths. Europe has around half of all cases and around 2 in 3 fatalities, and Dr. Kluge noted that the virus had the ability to overwhelm even the strongest health services in rich industrialized countries. After early optimistic signs of falling infection rates in 10 European nations, including Spain, Italy, France, Germany, and Switzerland, the WHO official expressed concern about rising pockets of cases in the UK, Turkey, Ukraine, Belarus, and the Russian Federation. The next few weeks will be critical for Europe, he said. Finally, and staying with the World Health Organization, WHO, it has said that the oral poliovirus vaccine should not be given to people to protect them against a new coronavirus, at least for the moment, in response to news that a clinical trial testing the polio vaccine's efficacy against COVID-19 is to begin in the United States. WHO said that it would assess the results when they are available. For the time being, and in the absence of any evidence, WHO maintained that it does not recommend using the oral vaccine other than for essential global polio eradication efforts, but it said that clinical studies could begin immediately on the possible protective effects of live vaccines such as polio and the BCG inoculation against tuberculosis because of their excellent safety record. These studies are in addition to other tests underway elsewhere using various drugs licensed for use against other diseases, such as the antiviral medication remdesivir and the antimalarial chloroquine. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Just speaking out against discrimination and xenophobia, speaking out in solidarity and showing support for the groups that are being attacked online, those expressions of support and solidarity are absolutely important.
Enabled by the devastating new sickness circling the earth, an old sickness, more of the mind than the body, is in danger of going viral at the same time. Professor Tendai Achiumi is the UN independent human rights expert on contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination and xenophobia, and she's been watching an explosion of intolerance alongside the coronavirus that has a long history dating back centuries. I'm Matt Wells, and for this special edition of our Lid Is On podcast from UN News, my colleague from our Chinese service, Siwen Xian, temporarily based back home while COVID-19 disrupts every aspect of our lives, has been talking to the special rapporteur about how hidden prejudices have been exploited by nationalist politicians and others she describes as entrepreneurs of intolerance to create a frightening new social and political dimension to this pandemic. Suen spoke to Yale-educated Professor Achumi, who was appointed by the Human Rights Council to her key job in November 2017, in mid-April, as the tsunami of infection had rippled from Wuhan to Europe, then striking the US, with New York City, home to UN headquarters, the epicenter of the world's worst pandemic in a century.
Certain nationalities or ethnicities have become targets of racism and xenophobia attacks. Maybe my first question would be, why did this happen precisely at the time when we should unite?
You're right to say that it's counterintuitive that at a time when there is so much risk and uncertainty that they would also be targeting of certain groups and what seems like increases in intolerance and prejudice. But I think it has to do with the fact that in emergency situations like these, underlying problems that exist are just exacerbated. Many of these groups are groups that are already subject to latent intolerance and xenophobia and prejudice. So take the example of Asian Americans or people who are perceived to be of Asian descent in the US right now who have been subject to xenophobic and racist attacks in the wake of COVID-19. You can think about, say, Africans who are being subject to various measures in China right now, also in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. You can think about Roma who are being targeted in different European countries and being accused of spreading the virus and being subject to extreme measures. Many members of those groups can tell you the long history of racial discrimination and xenophobia, even prior to there being a pandemic. These are groups that in general are vulnerable to racism and xenophobia. So I would say we should understand these attacks as laying bare in many places prejudices and biases that are often latent, and in this pandemic they become even more pronounced. And that combined with the fact that you actually have actors that you might think of as entrepreneurs of intolerance, certain actors, whether they're politicians, whether they're media outlets, seek actually to profit and to exacerbate and to inflame intolerance, jumping into the fray. And here I'm referring to political leaders who've been willing to come out and make statements that are either explicitly or implicitly xenophobic. And in my statement that you referenced, I speak of this. The example here in the US of a president who repeatedly referred to the virus as China virus, and you see this happening in different parts of the world as well. This kind of statement at high levels of political office, if you ask me, signals an acceptability of stigmatization of specific regions or specific groups of people who come from those regions.
Presumably these narratives or actions are very harmful.
Absolutely. The individuals and the groups who are the subject of the racism and the xenophobia, because they are of a particular ethnicity, a particular race, of a particular national origin. And sometimes it's because they're presumed to be. You have examples of Vietnamese people who are being attacked and their attackers are referring to them as Chinese. We're seeing examples in the US of verbal attacks, of social stigmatization. So when you're walking down the street and let's say you are perceived to be of Asian descent, people just, yes, there's social distancing, but there's also those glares and the kind of wide berth that speaks to something racialized taking place. There's been examples of spitting. And then there's also just physical violence, people who are being beaten up because they are presumed to be of an ethnicity or a racial designation that is associated with having spread disease, which we know this is not how they work. It's not those groups are more prone to the virus, but this is what's happening. In Europe, you have examples of people being denied access to goods and services. And some of the examples that I've been looking at, which were published in the European Union's Fundamental Rights agency, they just had a report out on COVID-19, and there's a section in there that talks about discrimination, and it talks about people of Asian descent or who are perceived to be of Asian descent being refused the right to rent in apartments. People are being refused access to healthcare. These are just examples. I'm not saying this is everywhere in Europe, but these are examples that are highlighted in the report. They also talk about people of Asian descent being denied access to restaurants, access to schools. This is before some of the measures were implemented. And then in China, Africans being evicted from their residence in Guangzhou, people having their passports seized, denial of access to restaurants. So those are examples of the kinds of harms that individuals and groups are experiencing. Also want to highlight the mental and emotional costs and the fear that these groups have to carry as a result of these attacks. I also want to highlight harm to the broader society. In the face of a pandemic like this, racism and xenophobia actually puts everybody at risk. If you use racial profiling in your public health enforcement, you put your entire population at risk because the virus isn't obeying racial rules. There was anecdotal accounts of people in airports in different parts of the country being singled out for questions about COVID-19, for testing on the basis of appearance. So people perceived as Asians being stopped at airports.
I were one of the targets. What should I do apart from feeling scared and hiding? Yeah.
The first thing I think is you absolutely have to take care of yourself. The first thing that you have to prioritize is your safety. If you feel safe, it is very important for people who are experiencing attacks or any kind of discrimination or intolerance to report the incidents. And hopefully people are in places where they feel safe to report the incidents to the authorities, to the police, or to whatever mechanism may exist for making reports. Reporting is important for two reasons. One has to do with accountability, but it's also important for creating a record. One of the challenges in terms of combating xenophobic and intolerant and racist acts can be this lack of actionable data. And sometimes that's because communities don't feel comfortable or don't feel safe reporting, or they feel that if they report, nothing will happen. Nothing ever gets done. The person is never really apprehended. Even if you don't think that people are going to be apprehending, reporting creates a record, and it really speaks to how pervasive the nature of a problem is. And at least in the US, I know, and this may be true in other places as well, there have been also private organizations that have taken on the work of trying to document attacks. So if you can't go to the police, it may be that there's an affinity group in your country, in your neighborhood, in your region that may be able to collect information. The Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, for example, has a hotline that they've been using to collect data. And then moving beyond just the individuals who are subject to these attacks, sometimes we think that when racism or xenophobia happens, it has to be the groups that are targeted who have to take the action. Absolutely not. There is a role for everybody. And one thing that we all can do is speak out against discrimination and xenophobia and intolerance. One of the things that can be hardest about intolerance, xenophobia, racism is feeling as though the world or the broader population or the majority ethnicity doesn't really care about your conditions because they don't speak out when these kinds of incidents take place. So I think showing solidarity, even if it's just on social media, not all problems can be solved by social media advocacy. But I do think just speaking out against discrimination and xenophobia, speaking out in solidarity and showing support for the groups that are being attacked online, those expressions of support and solidarity are absolutely important. For governments, I think that they have to ensure that they have the processes and the mechanisms in place to actually take complaints seriously in order for there to be accountability for these attacks. Where they can be, there has to be places where people can go and policies in place to these kinds of attacks. And so governments really have to commit in this area. And in some places, I'm receiving reports that point to discrimination also at the law enforcement level, including cases where people are being dismissed. You go to report a case of intolerance and you're being dismissed in a way that speaks to racial discrimination within the law enforcement context as well. The media have to take responsibility as well here. There's been some very good media reporting that has attempted to push back on stereotypes and on prejudice, but there's also been some examples of, I think, xenophobic coverage. When there's media coverage of Africans in Africa, likely the kind of coverage that is being, that can dominate, and this is not just in China, but in other parts of the world outside of the continent, there's a way of portraying others that can mean when a crisis occurs, all we have to fall back on are these stereotypes that are in movies and music videos, you know, just like in all over in places that are completely unrelated. And then the final thing I will say is education. I think there's a need for people to educate themselves on the conditions that racial and ethnic minority groups are experiencing, on how these groups are marginalized structurally and systemically, the histories that come along with them, and how inaction itself can be part of the problem. Part of the challenge is getting people to see other people as human beings, and then also connect the ways in which you experience discrimination to the ways in which other people experience discrimination. So we've been talking about the treatment of Africans in China. You might think about the treatment of Chinese on the African continent, right?
And the yeah, exactly. They should feel, you know, sympathy and
exactly.
Yeah, but some and, people are apparently just can't.
And I think because there's just things that we are exposed to that are supposed to teach us about the rest of the world are not doing a good enough job of making it hard for that kind of a thing, that kind of dissonance to exist. But it's why I keep coming back to education. You know, I really do think that education makes a very big difference. If we are relying on stereotypes about each other and where we come from, and some of these stereotypes are really deep. These stereotypes about refugees and migrants carrying disease, for example. And usually when we're thinking about migrants and refugees, typically the images that are conjured up in most minds are images of non-white poor individuals who are moving. And we know that there are migrants and refugees who fall outside of that category, but even the category of refugees and migrants who we think carry diseases are racialized. Why do we think that? You know, what do we see in the media? What do we hear politicians say that reinforce those ideas so that everything we know about science and medicine and the way the diseases are communicated can be suspended in ways that mean we ourselves engage in acts that are discriminatory vis-a-vis specific groups? So I think education is absolutely key. And the more we can truly see other people as people, see other groups as full human beings, the harder it becomes to engage in casually discriminatory acts. I would really like to believe that. And if that's not the case, then we're in trouble.
Do you think this pandemic will exacerbate racial discrimination or xenophobia or hatred for ethnic minorities, people who are not native in every country? Do you think the progress we've made in ethnic equality will reverse because of what happened?
I think the answers to these questions are not determined in advance. And I think that it really just depends on the momentum and who's willing to exert the most energy and influence and voice in this period. I mentioned to you earlier that I really do think that there are groups that profit from xenophobia and racism, groups attempting to leveraging this. The countries where leaders have spoken out in xenophobic and racist ways, it's part of a larger political project to consolidate power in racial and ethnic terms. So I think there's a leadership question here. I think if we have strong leaders who speak out and who say this is completely unacceptable, if we have communities, and not just the communities that are affected, but even the communities that are not affected and communities that are never affected, also have to come out and really speak out and take the kind of action that means we don't go in the direction of racism, xenophobia getting worse. There is agency here. Nothing is determined. And one of the things that has been heartening for me is seeing all of the acts of solidarity and statements that groups have been making in support of those who are experiencing attacks. There's also been solidarity. It hasn't been all xenophobia and racism. There was a Syrian refugee in Germany willing to go grocery shopping for other groups whose story was being covered. To be on the receiving end of so much intolerance and to turn around and say, I'm going to do all of these things from the kindness of my heart. Those things are important to highlight as well. It can be easy to focus on all of the ways that we can resort to engaging with each other that are so unreasonable and irrational. But then I think we can also focus on radical acts of support and interconnection that are also going on in this time as well. We are capable of radical acts of love in the same way that we're capable of radical acts of intolerance. And I actually think the forces that stand to benefit from intolerance are hoping that all we see are the negative stories rather than the positive ones, because then we end up in that world that is only more intolerant at the end of this process.
When a pandemic is over, what can be done in areas such as legislation, policy shifts, or advocacy in order to avoid deepening racial divide and backsliding in racial equality and human rights for all?
One of the ways to ensure that the next time there is a pandemic, and you have to imagine that this is not a once-off thing, that the kind of xenophobia and racism, that backlash isn't quite as strong, I think, was just investing in fighting discrimination and promoting equality, even outside of the context of emergency situations. So when things go back to normal, those who have capacity should be investing in organizations and in groups that work on combating racial discrimination. In my capacity as Special Rapporteur, I've been stunned at how underfunded, even among human rights groups, and even in the context of international organizations with a commitment to human rights, I've been stunned at how little focus there is on combating racial discrimination and xenophobic discrimination relative to other areas. And so really just investing in that work, even when there isn't a crisis, is going to mean that structures and ways of understanding relations to each other are being maintained even before we get to a crisis point. So I think that's important. Students should be demanding more education on racial and xenophobic discrimination and how to combat it, to push for an education that helps them be more tolerant and more able to live in diverse contexts. Journalists, international humanitarian actors, lawyers, everybody who understands themselves to be invested in, say, the UN system or in a globally interconnected world, I think there is a need, again, to educate ourselves and others on the history and the present of racial and xenophobic discrimination in general, just so that, again, when there are pandemics, it's not coming from out of the blue, but there are structures in place and approaches that understand and connect these exceptional conditions to structures of exclusion that exist. Post-pandemic, rather than just going back to normal and thinking everything is okay, the question should be, if you're living, say, in Guangzhou, you know, what conditions are Africans living under in my city, and what can I do to make those conditions better? If you are a resident in New York City, ask yourself, you know, what might it be like living here as somebody of Asian descent, and what are the ways in which I can make my community a more welcoming and equitable space for those groups, even not in the context of COVID? So I think that kind of deep commitment is absolutely necessary, and we should be pushing back against any kind of sense that there's easy solutions and you can kind of just phone in and out. Honestly, I really think it is about putting in the time to see the kinds of worlds we want to live in. So to go back to where we started with this conversation, I think part of the reason why intolerance and the prejudice has been as pointed as we're seeing it be is because in the period leading up to it, there had been a disinvestment in insisting on equality and non-discrimination and no xenophobia and no racism in public discourse. I think there had just been a disinvestment in that, and we're seeing the consequences.
Well, that was Siwen Xian in conversation with the UN independent human rights expert Tendai Achiume, one of the outspoken special rapporteurs who shine a light on abuses throughout the world. In her case, the all-too-present scourge of contemporary racism, racial discrimination and xenophobia that's thriving alongside the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you for listening. I'm Matt Wells from UN News. Join us again soon, and you can hear more of our podcasts by going to our main website at news.un.org.
Radio with co-host Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.
welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is an appropriate day for our radio show and broadcast because it's National Ask an Atheist Day. And the Freedom from Religion Foundation, which produces this weekly show, is a membership group made up of atheists and agnostics. And we're sorry we can't take your calls, but maybe this show will answer some of your questions.
I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. And, of course, you could ask us a question at freethoughtradio@ffrf.org. If you listen to the show, we'll know you're listening, and we can perhaps on the next show respond to your question. This is the April 16th, 2020 edition of Free Thought Radio. Buzz Kemper again is doing the show in his own studio, downtown, Audio for the Arts, while Annie Laurie and I are speaking from our home in Madison, Wisconsin, a few miles from where Buzz is, and a few miles from the national office of the Freedom from Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Buzz.
Hello, Dan and Annie Laurie.
Thanks again.
My pleasure.
As I said, Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, and we're a membership group. And if you're a member, thank you. And if not, we'd love to have you join us today at ffrf.org. We are still sending out intro packets of our newspaper, Free Thought Today, which is a very good introduction to all the other things the Freedom from Religion Foundation does as a national state church watchdog, working to educate the public about the views of those of us who are personally free from religion. So you can go to our website, ffrf.org/donate to join, or you can click on the Ask for Info link at our homepage, and we'll be glad to be in touch with you.
In the second half of today's show, we're going to talk with Professor Ryan Burge of East Illinois University about his research uncovering a secret. I guess it's no secret to you listeners, but uncovering the fact that among all the religious groups in the United States, atheists and agnostics are the most politically active. He had an article about that, and it should be a fascinating interview.
And today is the anniversary of what, Dan?
Today, the music today on today's show is going to be Charlie Chaplin. He was born on April 16th. Today is the anniversary. 1889, the film director, the actor, the composer and conductor, who was known as the Little Tramp, starred and produced and wrote and scored many movies. He admired the philosopher Bertrand Russell. He agreed with the writings of the great freethinker Robert Ingersoll. Ingersoll's atheism, Chaplin wrote, confirmed my own belief that the horrific cruelty of the Old Testament was degrading to the human spirit. So listen for some of Chaplin's compositions today, including The Real Chaplin, that's spelled R-E-E-L, The Real Chaplin, The Clown's Apprentice, and Dancing on the Yacht.
So FFRF's TV show that's called Free Thought Matters, and it comes out on Sundays and is also now up on YouTube as of today. Each episode goes up on Thursdays. It features an interview of the psychologist and FFRF member Valerie Tirico, an author of a book called Trusting Doubt. She's a former evangelical Christian, and let's listen to this little teaser from her interview.
And I remember a very explicit experience in that context of working with one child, I think he was maybe 2 years old, who had a spinal cord tumor. No matter what happened, he was going to be paralyzed from the waist down. He probably was going to die. And in that context, as I listened to other people around me, the hospital chaplain and other people who were Christian believers, describe their attempts to rationalize this kind of suffering unto death of children in the context of their belief in an omnibenevolent, omniscient, interventionist deity, I couldn't do it. And I think at that point, I got angry at the God in my head. I look back, and I've said before that I was holding God together at that point with duct tape and baling wire. And I said to God, I'm not making excuses for you anymore. And it turned out at that point, when I stopped making excuses, God disappeared. That all that was left was the duct tape and baling wire.
You can hear the rest of that interview this Sunday on Free Thought Matters.
You can watch it, and it's also up on YouTube. It's on in about 12 cities, but you can go ahead and watch it today if you go to FFF's YouTube channel, and there's a playlist for Free Thought Matters, and I think you'll want to see the whole show. You may also have missed the interview last week with Ron Reagan, which is a lot of fun, so you can find all of the other shows there. And oops, he did it again. Vice President Pence was in the news again, shilling for the churches. Let's listen to what he was saying about giving them money.
Ministry has continued, and we are grateful for the role on this Holy Week that our churches, our synagogues, and all of our houses of worship have played. On their behalf, allow me to remind you that even if you're not in the pew this Easter Sunday, if you are able, it's still a good idea to give, because those ministries continue to go forward, and we encourage you. We encourage you to continue to support them.
So, of course, churches are now eligible for money from the Small Business Association under the new CARES Act, and first time ever that money will be going in this federal money will be going to churches like this, regardless of their need. So that's not enough for Pence. He had to beg for people to give money to churches for Easter. So we have a lot of violations like that this week, and we have been sending letters again individually to all of the governors who have refused to close down churches and religious meetings. We sent all of them a letter, original letter, several weeks ago, but now we're customizing it for the rogue governors, and those
like
include the governor of Ohio. We even had to send a letter to our generally progressive governor here in Wisconsin because he had said religions and groups under 10 could meet, and we have stats on that showing that even groups as small as 10 in churches have been spreading the coronavirus. And Dan, I think that you can talk about what you, the listener, can do.
So many of you have contacted us. You've been angry and worried that governors and other officials are exempting churches from the safe-at-home order. The past Easter Sunday was an example of exacerbating these exemptions. In response to this overwhelming and we think heartening volume of requests for how to hold our elected officials accountable, we've created a set of resources that you can use. FFRF's website now has a page specifically dedicated to secular activism in the time of coronavirus. If you're stuck at home, maybe feeling a little helpless and angry about this, that churches are risking people's lives or maybe even your own life, we want to help you fight back. We've sent a letter to all the governors, but you can report and you can directly contact and take action by going to our website, FFRF.org, go to the news link, and under news releases, you can scroll down to April 10th, and there you will find a link to how you can get involved in protecting the lives of Americans.
We have a memo that you can either draw upon or you can send it directly to your local public official, and they really do need to hear from constituents. And then we have something fun to report about this. We have a life member in Florida, Dwayne Free. He lives in Melbourne, and he has paid for an FFRF billboard that went up last Friday. It's a digital billboard. It's up for a month. And it's our stained glass window motif, very colorful. And the message is, science works. Please stay home. And regular listeners will know that Governor Ron DeSantis explicitly exempted churches from following social distancing requirements that endangers all of us. And so our member was very concerned about this and came up with this billboard solution. And he's right. Science works. The data works. This is the way to help slow the spread of the coronavirus, and churches should not be exempt. And speaking of national problems besides the coronavirus, here in Madison, Wisconsin, we became very aware of the need for universal vote by mail in Wisconsin's election last Tuesday. And you probably have followed the news that our governor tried to delay it to make people safe, and the Republicans sued, and our state Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court backed them up, and we had to have an election. Many people had asked for absentee ballots, and had not got them. Fortunately, Dan and I got ours and were able to vote by mail, but it was a real injustice because we were supposed to have several weeks to get those ballots back. And this shows the great need coming up in November for voting by mail. And it is a secular issue because this is something that affects our secular voters. It affects the young among us who have had barriers for voting. And we have a website press release up about that, and we'll be asking you and our members to do more to ask public officials to support universal voting by mail.
We have a neighbor just down the street here who is a poll worker who we talked to her the night before and the night after, and she was really worried. It's not that the voters can stay away from each other, but the poll workers are shoulder to shoulder. They're sitting there having to take extra precautions, worried about her own health.
Well, no one should have to risk their lives in order to exercise their fundamental civil right to vote. And this is what happened in Wisconsin. It was an affront to civil liberties and something that we should all be concerned about. Now, coming up, we have some fun things coming up in the next segment. We have Professor Ryan Burge, who has research revealing that atheists and agnostics are the most politically engaged religious group in the United States. And then we're going to end with a little comfort music, something fun.
Yeah, in this dark time, there's so much bad news, but we have an announcement to make about a brand new animated video that's online. We've been waiting a long time for this, and it's humorous, it's light, and it's a different take on the afterlife. So I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. And today is April the 16th. And 1 month ago, on March the 15th, was the National Day of Prayer. That was a Sunday. And at that time, it was starting to dawn on the president that there might be a problem with this virus. There were less than 100 U.S. deaths on March the 15th, but after this amazing day of prayer that he called, the death rate...
He tweeted it, you mean?
Well, he tweeted it, yeah. Yeah, he did it by tweet. The death rate since then, what do you think has happened? It has skyrocketed. I just checked this morning, and today on April 16th, there are more than 28,000 tragic U.S. deaths. That's very sad. But it does show us that prayer is useless, and what we really need are human actions.
And a sad proof of the failure of prayer happened this past weekend in a church outside of Richmond, Virginia. Bishop Gerald Glenn, founder of the New Deliverance Evangelical Church, which is Pentecostal, in Chesterfield, Virginia, died of COVID-19 on the eve of Easter after contracting the novel coronavirus. Pastor Glenn had encouraged people not to stay home, but to come to church. He had said, "God is larger than this dreaded virus." The morning after he died, which was Easter Sunday, church elder Brian Nevers said, "We still believe in God for healing right now. Our bishop always told us, even as they wheeled him into the operating room, he proclaimed that God is still a healer I don't know how, but I have to say God will get the glory from this. So this is really pathetic.
Well, there was a lot of supposed glory of God this Easter weekend, especially on Easter Day, with all these storms, these powerful acts of God that blew through the South. In Tennessee, there's a church in Bradley County, Tennessee, not far from Dayton, Tennessee, where these violent storms and tornado badly damaged the Church of Jesus Christ, which was on Benton Pike. The pastor, Dennis Hicks, came to find the walls were blown out. And you can see online, the walls are totally blown out, and the inside of that church is totally scattered. And they're wondering, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to rebuild? They don't think to curse God, do they? But they want to thank God when things go right. Further south of there, down in Dora, Alabama, there was a church called Lawler Missionary Baptist Church. It was hit by a tornado, and the roof was badly damaged. But in front of the church, there were three crosses, you know, the three crosses of Gethsemane. Two on the sides had been knocked over, but the middle one was left standing. And all the people were saying, this is a sign of God's power, that the cross of Jesus was not destroyed. Well, then how do they explain this? About an hour drive north of there in Priceville, Alabama, the Shoal Creek Baptist Church, they had their Easter morning service in their cars. They stayed in the parking lot.
Well, that's good for them then.
Yeah, because the governor had just issued the stay-at-home order. And so about an hour after their service on Easter Sunday, lightning struck the steeple and totally destroyed the cross and the steeple. It caused a fire and massive damage to the church. Fire departments from two counties had to come and put out the blaze. The pastor said that they were thanking God that nobody was in the building at that time due to the governor's stay-at-home order. Well, why aren't they agreeing with us that that lightning strike was an act of God?
Well, they'll always find a way that God gets the credit and never the blame. Although the curve seems to be flattening, this is not a result of an act of God. Governor Cuomo of New York recognizes that it is human actions, not divine actions, that will defeat the virus.
We're talking about a reopening that has a public health plan and an economic plan totally coordinated. Our behavior has stopped the spread of the virus. God did not stop the spread of the virus. And what we do, how we act, will dictate how that virus spread.
You should have seen the face of the woman host when he said that. She didn't know what to say. God did not stop the virus. She kind of looked shocked.
Well, science and human reason are what we need here. So, for a change of pace, America's Best Christian, Betty Bowers, which is an act written by Andrew Bradley. Both of them performed at FFRF's recent convention last year. Betty Bowers had something to say this week in her new video, Thou Shalt Stay the Hell at Home.
Hark! I'm Mrs. Betty Bowers, America's Best Christian. Trademark. As such, I get to tell lesser Christians, that would be you, what you're doing to annoy Jesus. Oh, goodness, where to start? Oh, I know. How about Christians who continue to crowd into churches during a global pandemic? No, don't smite them just yet, Jesus. Yeah, me too, but at least allow the mercy of me warning them first. Oh, stop. Maybe you've seen the video of the woman driving to church saying she isn't worried about getting sick because...
I'm covered in Jesus' blood.
Just think of her dry cleaning bills. Okay, but first of all, if you want to reassure people you're healthy, particularly mentally, the technique of telling them you're covered in blood needs a little work. But that same woman said she goes to the grocery store every day. So maybe this is not about being so devout you have to go to church, but being so selfish you have to do whatever the hell you want, no matter whom you kill. Because I wanted to ask her, even if you think Jesus cast a sticky magical spell to make you asymptomatic, what about all the other people you come in contact with at that store? People who aren't covered in blood. What are they? Just collateral damage to your need to show your neighbors how pious you are by still going to church? What? You think God is too lazy to make a house call? Well, then maybe you need to find a God who, when he says he's everywhere, actually is everywhere, not just in one building with loud wall-to-wall carpeting, a bad soft rock band, and 24 collection plates. People are ordering in food to save lives, and if your God doesn't deliver, you need to find one with better Yelp reviews. Or, here's an idea. Why don't you look for a God you can actually follow, if only for the novelty? Remember, before you climb into that sedan the Lord blessed you with, the God you pretend to follow, Jesus told you to pray in private, not public, Matthew 6:5-6. Yes, I get it. Making a big spectacle of praying in public is one of America's top 10 favorite ways to ignore Jesus. We even have whole days set aside for it. But you'd think you might make an exception and listen to Jesus for once when praying in large groups might, oh, I don't know, kill thousands of people. Remember that thou shalt not kill thing. Yeah, it's one of the commandments you follow, convenience permitting. But if you can't do some social distancing from your church to spend some one-on-one time alone at home with God, maybe going to church is less about showing up than it is about showing off. Because what's the fun of praying, speaking in tongues, or waving your hands in the air to show how moved you are by the Spirit if you don't have an audience to see how gosh darn holier you are than everyone who stayed home? I get it. You smugly don't worry about a swarming pestilence. You think you're too blessed and highly favored to be its next victim. But remember that great flood? Killing all the firstborns, the sky raining burning sulfur, the Lord's wrath is hardly known for its pinpoint accuracy. And I understand that this new gimmick called religious freedom has convinced you that your choice to go to a church is more important than anything, even other Americans' civil rights. So now, you've taken this self-importance one step further and think your choice to go to a church is more important than even other Americans' rights to live. Spoiler, it's not. So verily I say unto thee, thou shalt stay the hell home.
Your pastor guilting you into attending church isn't a test of your faith. It's a test of your pastor's willingness to go without full collection plates.
So that was Betty Bowers in the
America's,
new video.
America's Best Christian.
Thou Shalt Stay the Hell at Home. And that was written by Andrew Bradley. And by the way, Andrew Bradley and Betty Bowers, of course, the actress Devon Green, we're at our convention, but you can read Andrew Bradley's excellent speech in the current issue of Free Thought Today. Just ask at info@ffref.org or go to our homepage and ask for information.
And you can also watch all the Betty Bowers videos on their America's Best Christian YouTube station. So we're going to take a break. Stay tuned for our interview with Professor Ryan Burge, whose research reveals that atheists and agnostics are the most politically engaged religious group
in
the United States. And we vote and we're active. We go to marches in that, and even then, more than evangelicals.
And then we'll end with our weekly comfort music.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Hello, this is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we have on the phone with us from Mount Vernon, Illinois, Ryan Burge, who's an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University that's located in Charleston, Illinois. Professor Burge teaches American institutions, political behavior, research methods, focuses largely on the intersection between religiosity and political behavior. And we were fascinated by a recent blog that Ryan Burge had up on the website Religion in Public. His blog can be found at religioninpublic.blog on April 13th. And the headline is, Atheists are the most politically active group in the United States. So we are very intrigued about this, and we want to welcome to Free Thought Radio Professor Ryan Burge. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
So you start off this blog saying it's almost a trope among people who study and write about American religion and politics that evangelicals punch way above their weight. So first tell us a little bit about that trope.
Yeah, so the lion's share of writing in religion and politics, American religion and politics, is about evangelicals and specifically white evangelicals. I would venture to guess that most of the things published in academic journals over the last 15 or 20 years have been about the political behaviors and activities and public opinions of evangelical Christians. And one of the sort of perplexing things about them is that they've gotten smaller over time because the white share of the population has gotten smaller, but also evangelicals have gotten slightly smaller over the last decade. But at the ballot box, they still have exactly the same influence they had 10 or 15 years ago, even though their relative size has declined. And that's largely because they turn out to vote a lot. And that's largely because a lot of them are older. A lot of them are white. Their education level is actually pretty high. And so we know those are all factors that lead to people voting more. And so the lion's share of all the work and attention has been paid to these white evangelicals, but I was poking around the data one day and I saw that maybe that we should be focusing on other groups out there as well.
Well, you know, I used to be a white evangelical Christian. I was a minister for 19 years and before I changed my mind. And I can say that from my experience, evangelicals are motivated. They really do think they're on a mission from God, and they really do want to clean up the country. So they get to the polls because they want to agitate for their causes. You're now saying that they're not the only group who's so motivated.
That's right. I mean, my research shows pretty clearly here that, I mean, looking at large-scale data sets, the data set I used primarily in the piece was over 60,000 respondents, and about 6% of them were atheists. So we're talking about a sample of almost 4,000 atheists, so lots and lots of people here. I see that at all education levels, atheists are actually more politically active. Now, by politically active, I don't mean voting. What I mean is doing other political things, like contacting a public official, going to a local political meeting, putting up a yard sign, working for a candidate, donating money to a candidate. On all those measures, we see that atheists are either at the top or close to the top in terms of total level of activity around politics. And obviously a lot of that activity that will then translate to the ballot box, because a lot of people are not going to put up a yard sign then not go vote, or, you know, donate to a candidate then not go vote for that candidate later on. So what we know is that atheists, even though they're only 6% of the population, are also sort of starting to punch above their weight, both at the ballot box and just in the political sphere overall.
So it's atheists, and then you also include agnostics in there, mm-hmm. which match pretty much like atheists, right?
Yeah, I think like when I describe agnostics to people, it's like they're like a 5% less version of atheists. They're slightly more likely to go to church. They're slightly more likely to say religion is important to them, but just barely, maybe 5% more likely. And they're slightly less politically engaged, but not by much. They're also 6% of the population, by the way. And I've had a lot of people ask me, like, so how do I define atheist or agnostic? The question asks, what's your current religious, you know, preference? And atheist is an option, and agnostic's an option, and nothing in particular is an option. So whatever you pick is what you are. It's not what you believe. It's what you say you are, and that's really the most important thing to me as a social scientist.
Self-identified as. So I have a question for you, Professor Burge, which is, you were looking at the Cooperative Congressional Election Survey, asking these questions about political activity in the past 12 months. What about Pew and all the other groups that are showing that the nones, N-O-N-E-S, those who are non-affiliated, who identify just as non-religious but not necessarily atheists and agnostics, are actually 26% of the population? How did
yeah,
how
so
does this
a lot,
survey?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so this is actually a super complicated question, and I don't want to go too much in the weeds on it, but it comes down to survey methodology. I don't want to use the word famous, but I got sort of a online following by posting a graph where I showed the general social survey where the nuns had got to 23.1%, which means they were the same size as evangelicals or Catholics. But in the CCES, the number is actually much higher than that because it's 31.3%. And the reason is it's because the GSS basically asks, what's your current religion? And then the option is no religion. The CCS gives you three options to be a nun: atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. Atheists are about 6%, agnostics are about 6%, and then this group called nothing in particular is about 19%. So if you add those three groups together, you get to 31% using a different methodology than what Pew uses or what the GSS uses. So when someone asks me what percentage of Americans are nuns, I think the answer is it's somewhere between 25 and 30% based on how you ask the question.
So what about the people who said they didn't have a religion but didn't identify as atheist or agnostic in this congressional election survey? How did they come down with political activity?
Yeah, so that's the group. The other group that I didn't put in here because it would really sort of – I didn't want to focus on them just yet. I have other things coming that I'll focus on. Is this nothing in particular group? That's where 1 in 5 Americans say there's nothing in particular now. There's also a something else option, by the way, which ends up being a grab bag of like Jedis and Wiccans and pagans and all this other stuff, right? The nothing in particular group is actually super interesting because they have very, very low levels of education. They're one of the least educated groups in America today. Like less than 25% of them have a college degree compared to 45% of atheists. And they're very much disengaged from society. They don't do things like contact public officials. So that group is actually concerning for me from a social science perspective because they have low income, low education, and they're sort of disaffected and sort of unmoored from society. And those are problematic things.
So that is very interesting because when we survey our own members, very high percentages of college and beyond college education, very engaged volunteers and so on.
And 90% or so who actually are registered to vote of our membership.
Yeah, 97%.
High number.
But they're and also older. Our average member is 67 or older.
Holy cow, that's as old as mainline Protestants, like your United Methodist, your Episcopalian.
Right.
The average evangelical today is in their late 50s or early 60s. The average mainline Protestant is 67 years old today. So that's another thing going on. There's this demography thing going on in America where white people are getting older, especially white Christians are getting older. I mean, many of the largest denominations in America, 40% are over the age of 60. So you got to think in the next 20 years, you're going to see a lot of decline in size just because of death.
Yeah.
So we want to get those young people voting. How are they doing?
So young, I don't look at age specifically here, but what we do know is that education sort of drives voting. I will say the one thing that we've learned, we've always known this, but like the recent campaign with Bernie Sanders just sort of made that clear to us. It's really a bad idea to build a coalition on young people and hoping they'll come out to vote because they just don't as a general rule. Education will drive that up. But again, young people obviously don't have as much opportunity to get the education because they haven't lived long enough to, let's say, go to college or get a graduate degree and all those things. But there definitely is a relationship where the older you are, actually it sort of peaks. It's called a curvilinear relationship. So really your peak political activity happens between like 30 and 60 or 65. And then once you get above that age, people start having health problems. They don't go out as much. They don't engage as much. And it sort of tapers off as they move into later in life.
So we're almost out of time. This has gone fast. But your blog points out that one of the reasons that the blue wave happened in 2018 is you think there was a very agitated base of atheists who got politically involved.
Yeah. That's actually, I think, a super important point. And being out of power, that's an incredibly interesting way of making people more active and engaged. If you look at the numbers for atheists, their activity from 2016 to 2018 jumped pretty significantly, jumped about 0.15 activities. But while for Catholics and Protestants, it just fell off the table. I mean, dramatically declined for Catholics and Protestants because it's easy to get complacent when your party owns both houses of Congress and the White House. You know, you've won. You've gotten there. It's easy just to sit back on your laurels. And for liberal groups like atheists who are 75% Democrats, whenever you see that you don't have the House, the Senate, or the White House, you want to get out there and get things happening. And that's probably one of the reasons we saw the blue wave was because the Democrats, not just atheists, but all Democrats, got agitated, got angry, got organized, and went out there and drove the vote and, you know, got the blue wave happening.
So your story says that 31% of atheists are Republican,
yep,
61% Democrat, and then almost 7% independent. So it's not like it's a solid block, but we non-believers tend to lean more liberal, of course.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, atheists and agnostics are probably, besides Black Protestants, are probably the most liberal religious group in America today. But the thing, and this is something that we're just starting to see now, is if the nuns are getting larger, it used to be if you were a nun, it's because you had a very specific political ideology, you were probably younger, higher levels of education. When they were 5% of the population, you can get a pretty homogenous group of people. But when they can become 25% of the population, they're going to attract independents. They're going to attract Republicans. They're going to attract libertarians, right? They're going to attract older people. So you've got to think that the nuns are going to become more politically diverse as they grow larger, which is interesting, because are they going to sort of faction themselves off and say, wait, I'm not that kind of nun, I'm this kind of nun, and things like that?
Well, one thing we have seen at the Freedom From Religion Foundation is extremely strong support for reproductive rights across the board.
Yep.
It's the need to keep religion religious dogma out of our government seems to be a very core principle among the 30,000 plus members of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Well, the corollary is that's what motivates evangelicals. They are also concerned.
Yeah, abortion is like, it's this mythical thing in American public opinion where we fought, we spent money, we've had all this culture war discussion for the last 40 years, and basically opinion is essentially the same today as it was right after Roe. So these dog fights have just pushed us back and forth, and the middle has basically stayed where it is. The issue that's really fascinating to me is gay marriage. In 1988, 12% of Americans were in favor of gay marriage. In 2018, it was 66% of Americans, right?
Yeah.
So there are some areas where the culture war has definitely switched, right? And we've moved more towards a liberal direction. But abortion, for whatever reason, it's a very interesting sort of singular issue that way. All these fights and all the discussion has basically not moved the needle in public opinion on abortion at all in the last 35 or 40 years.
Huh. I have two grandsons in California who are early 20-somethings, and they're both engaged and involved. They're non-believers, and they were proud of the fact that they voted. So I'm wondering if that will translate someday into the young people making a real difference in our politics.
I hope so. I mean, we always want young people to vote no matter what. Like, I think that's always a good thing from a political science perspective. You did bring up an interesting point, though, which is now we're having second and third generation nuns, which is a whole new thing for American society, right? It used to be you had to sort of convert to being a nun or like deconvert from your religion. Now people becoming a nun is going to be much more accepted because maybe your parents were nuns and maybe even your grandparents were nuns. We're going to see third generation nuns pretty soon, which is something we've never seen before in American society.
Well, Annie Laurie's an exception.
Yeah, we have to spell that again. N-O-N-E-S. None of the above on religion. Yeah, I'm a third generation
freethinker. She's third generation.
On my mother's side of the family.
Very rare, for sure.
Well, we've surveyed our members, and some of them are fifth generation older members. So,
wow.
But they're a rarity. But yes, we're going to see this is going to be much more common. And
absolutely.
I think we have a minute left. I thought it was fascinating that you found that atheists, a quarter of atheists had attended a march or protest, and that compared to only 4% of white evangelicals.
Yeah, there's. That's a fascinating finding to me, because we always assume that evangelicals are the ones out there holding the signs about abortion and gay marriage and this kind of thing. I think what we have to be very careful is the idea that there's a lot of people in America who are not politically engaged at all, and the media does not cover them because there's nothing to cover, right? I had one of my friends tell me she was in a focus group one time, and they were talking to mainline Protestants, and one of them raised their hand and goes, you know what? The problem is that moderates don't march. Right. And that's a huge chunk of the American electorate is moderate people who, will go vote and maybe will, maybe go to a primary or something like that. But they don't want to get out and hold a sign during a protest. So that kind of behavior is for atheists, it's a quarter of all atheists. But for everybody else, it's basically less than 10%. So it just shows you like how agitated atheists are right now.
Well, I guess I'm in that agitated group because I like nothing better than getting on a picket line.
Yeah. She's in a secular heaven when she does that.
I was on my first picket, a feminist picket, when I was 14.
Well, we're out of time here. Thank you, Professor Ryan Burge, is a professor at East Illinois University. Thanks for writing that fascinating blog.
Yes, thanks so much for joining us today. We'll have to
have
you back on.
Absolutely. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So stay tuned. We're going to take a break here, and there's a little bit of Charlie Chaplin music. It's Charlie Chaplin's birthday today, and Charlie Chaplin was one of those nuns, was one of those non-believers. After the break, we're going to have, in this dark time that we've been talking about, we're going to have a little bit of comfort music. Annie Laura will introduce a brand new offering of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a brand new animated video called Heaven, and the word heaven is in quotes. So I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylord.
Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
And I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. Well, the news has been, of course, very dark the past few weeks. So to lighten the mood a little, the Freedom From Religion Foundation has posted an animated music video. It's our first animated music video. And it's based on the song Heaven by Rupert Brooke. It's a poem. And Dan, my co-host, Dan Barker, has put it to music. We have played it before on Free Thought Radio, usually to celebrate the birthday of freethinker Rupert Brooke. He wrote this poem in 1913. He was British, and he died very tragically during World War I. And this is an irreverent poem about heaven from the point of view of a fish. And, of course, there's a lot of cute quips about heaven and hell, Mark Twain, heaven is for company, hell for climate, and so forth. But this is really my favorite take.
You got it backwards. Heaven for
heaven for climate,
hell for company.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
And so we have the video up on FFRF's YouTube channel, and it's magically illustrated by Katie Troy, who is a new art grad, the daughter of one of our employees. Very talented, and so we want you to watch it, but we thought this is also very good comfort music. Yo-Yo Ma has started this tradition of playing comfort music during the time of the coronavirus. So you can go find this on YouTube, but let's listen to Heaven by Rupert Brooke.
Fish, fly replete in depth of June, dawdling away their watery noon, ponder deep wisdom, dark or clear, each secret fishy hope or fear. Fish say they have their stream and pond, but is there anything beyond? This life cannot be all they swear, for how unpleasant if it were. One may not doubt that somehow good shall come of water and of mud, and surely reverent I must see a purpose in liquidity. We darkly know, by faith we cry, the future is not wholly dry. Mud unto mud, death eddies near. Not here, the appointed end, not here. But somewhere beyond space and time is wetter water, slimier slime, and there they trust there swimmeth one
who swam ere rivers were begun. Immense, of fishy form and mind, Squamous, omnipotent and kind, and under that almighty fin, the littlest fish may enter in. Oh, never fly conceals a hook, fish say, in the eternal brook. But more than mundane weeds are there, and mud celestially fair. Fat caterpillars drift around, and paradisal grubs are found. Unfading moths, immortal flies, and the worm that never dies. And in that heaven of all their wish, there shall be no more land save fish.
Heaven from the point of view of a fish, slimy or slime, and no more land. And it's just a very charming take. And you have to watch it because Katie Troy's animated work is just, as I said, magical, very charming. It's very, very cute. So we hope you'll go find that on FFF's YouTube channel and share that.
Well, that's our show for today. Again, we want to thank you, Buzz, doing a great job, long distance. We're not staying at home, but we're staying separated to produce the show. And usually we produce it in the Stephen Yule Friendly Atheist studio, but of course we're all...
Well, you and I are at home, Dan.
Yeah, I know.
Buzz is in his studio.
So it's totally
separated.
Different. But we want to say greetings to and thanks to all of you listeners, those of you who are listening to us on the radio in the Philadelphia area, to WOOM. LP, also heard over in New Jersey. Here in Madison, Wisconsin, there are two. There's a low-power station, WMUU. There's also WIDE. Down in Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR Community Radio. In Central Texas, hello to listeners to KEOS over by College Station. In Columbia, Missouri, KOPN, one of our favorite stations. WOOL, Black Sheep Radio in Vermont and in New Hampshire, right on the border. WRFI in Ithaca in Watkins Glen, New York. And, of course, we want to thank all of you podcast listeners and give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider, encouraging others to listen to Free Thought Radio or to visit our website about the radio show, ffrf.org/radio.
As I said, we'd be glad to send you a copy of our newspaper, the April issue of Free Thought Today, which is jam-packed with really wonderful articles, including by Andrew Bradley, Betty Bowers, creator, and so forth.
Who we heard earlier.
And you can go to our website, ffrf.org, and click on that info link, or better yet, go to ffrf.org/donate and become a member and help swell our ranks. We're very close to 32,000 current members in North America, and we'd love to have you join us. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.